This April, the EarthX 2024 Congress of Conferences is the sustainability summit you won't want to miss. 5 days of conferences covering the built environment, the natural environment, e-capital, oceans, and conservation. EarthX brings together people from all sides to engage in powerful conversations, from business executives, nonprofits, and educators in energy, tech, media, and beyond, for one important mission: protecting our planet. Please join us and register at earthx.org. Use code EXGREEN20 and receive a 20% discount off your registration. I'm Crystal Zimicelli, and welcome to the Forces for Nature show. Do you find yourself overwhelmed with all the doom and gloom you hear of these days? Do you feel like you, as just one person, can't really make a difference? Forces for Nature cuts through that negativity. In each episode, I interview somebody who's doing great things for animals and the environment. We talk through the problem they're addressing, the solution they have found, what keeps them going, and we'll leave you with practical action tips so that you too can become a force for nature. Today's guest is Tadzio Berroots. He's the director of the Dutch Caribbean Nature Alliance and a strong advocate for sharks. He recently created the Caribbean Shark Coalition, which aims to foster collaboration among various stakeholders throughout this region to increase its capacity for protecting these vital species. Their necessity to the ecosystem as an apex predator cannot be overstated, with Tadzio seeing the effects of their removal firsthand. We discuss people's fear, the surprising way to tame a shark, and how protection cannot be done piecemeal. Let's dive in. Hi, Tadzio. Thank you so much for joining me on Forces for Nature. It's so great to have you.
The pleasure is all mine. I'm very excited and looking forward to our chat together.
Today, I want to talk about sharks, one of the most feared species out there. Let's first address this sentiment. Although movies have greatly exaggerated their aggressiveness, I did read a statistic recently that says shark attacks are on the rise, but shark-related deaths are decreasing. Can you help to clarify?
I don't think that there is an increase in shark populations or increase in sharks frequenting coastal waters. Actually, the opposite is the case. Sharks are under immense pressure globally from overfishing. But what I do think is happening is that as the human population is growing and as more people move towards the coastlines and more people make use of coastal areas, there'll be inevitably some negative human-shark interactions. That's really what's going on. Statistically, it's still a very small chance that you can have a negative human-shark interaction. Some of the statistics out there, you're more likely to get hit on the head by a falling coconut while you sit under a coconut tree on some tropical beach somewhere, rather than get nipped by a shark.
Now, you spend a lot of time in the water with sharks. Do you ever worry about being attacked?
I never really worry. I mean, during our research, it's not true that I never worry. I'm very cautious. I think there is a misconception out there, especially fostered by some people on social media, by quote-unquote influencers, that sharks are these harmless creatures that can be petted and that you can touch, etc., etc. But what I always tell people is that these are apex predators. These are animals that are at the very top of their food chain. They also have the equipment necessary to be able to function at the very top of the food chain, and they can cause some serious harm if you don't have a healthy respect for the animal, for what they're capable of. There have been a few species, actually, that I'm a little bit more wary of than others. Reef sharks, tiger sharks, hammerheads. I've never had the pleasure of being in the water with a great white, but I'm sure it's the same. They are animals that you keep eye contact with, and you're aware of their presence, and you don't do anything too risky underwater and keep your hands to yourself. 99% of the time, there's nothing to worry about. The only species that makes me a little bit wary when they come around are bull sharks. Bull sharks are these massive, chunky animals that when they come around, you can tell that they mean business. They also have the highest level of testosterone of any animal in the animal kingdom. So they're basically a hopped up teenage boy that's swimming through and trying to make its presence felt. So there have been a few times when I've been in the water in the Bahamas, for example, been doing work with hammerheads, or even down here in the Eastern Caribbean, doing work with tigers or reef sharks, for example, that a bull shark has come through and made its presence felt. And that's when I usually get a little bit cautious. I keep a little bit of an extra eye on the animal. And if I notice that it's being a little bit too inquisitive or wants to come and check me out more than two or three times, that's usually when I call it and be like, all right, let's give this animal its space and let's reconvene somewhere else or come back tomorrow or come up with another plan. They're wild animals and you need to have a healthy respect for them. It's not as if you're going to go to the plains of Africa and try to jump on the back of a lion and ride it around either. So that's what I usually tell people.
That's a really good comparison, actually. Out of curiosity, side note question, is it the bull shark or is it the tiger shark that can go up estuaries?
Bull sharks, they have their metabolism is in a way that it allows them to swim up into freshwater ecosystems. I mean, not only estuaries, they've been found 1,200 miles up the Mississippi River. Yeah, some of the biggest bull sharks that have ever been caught have been caught in freshwater rivers in South Africa, for example. Also, some highly brackish water ecosystems in Australia, some of the biggest bull sharks have ever been caught. Lake Nicaragua, for example, in Central America, which is a completely fresh body of water, has a healthy population of bull sharks. So it's quite unique in the sense that they're able to venture into freshwater ecosystems. So in that sense, they're quite interesting creatures.
It's funny, actually, that you bring up Lake Nicaragua, because I was just the other night speaking with some Nicaraguan friends who told me that the shark population in the lake has been decimated because of shark finning. And so that leads into my next question, where I want to say that shark numbers and populations have been declining drastically over the past years. And some primary culprits are them being fished for their meat intentionally, being caught as bycatch unintentionally, and the inhumane practice of shark finning. Can you explain what shark finning is and why it's done?
So yeah, you're absolutely right. Sharks are some of the most threatened and endangered species, not only in the oceans, but generally speaking about the animal kingdom. Some large shark species, hammerheads, oceanic white tips, mako sharks, etc., their population has declined by about 90% compared to just two decades ago. So in 20 years, their population has declined 90%, which is a quite drastic decline. Estimates range from 150 to 500 million sharks are caught yearly. And most of this catch is driven by the shark fin trade. Certain Asian cultures, shark fin soup especially is seen as a status symbol, as an aphrodisiac. It's used a lot in weddings, and it has this connotation of being a folk remedy that will increase fertility, etc., which, of course, none of this is ever based in any real fact or any real scientific data.
How is it done?
Unfortunately for the shark, the way that the finning often happens is that the shark is caught, whether intentionally or not. The fins are cut off of the shark while the animal is still alive, and then the animal is just chucked overboard while it is still alive.
Without fins.
Yeah, without fins. The problem with that is, aside from just cutting the fin off of a live animal and throwing it back overboard, is that the majority of the species of sharks actually need to be able to swim to be able to pump water over their gills. So what essentially happens if you cut their fins off, which is already horrible, and you drop them overboard, they're unable to aerate oxygen over their gills, which they do through swimming, and then they'll inevitably drown. So it's really a horrible practice. Luckily, there's quite a bit of a movement globally to stem the shark fin trade, but we still have a long way to go.
Where would one begin?
It's not only targeting fisheries. I mean, oftentimes shark finning happens in areas where poverty is an issue. Some fishermen go out, they fish in areas that are heavily overfished, they come across a shark, and then they know that they can make 100, 150 bucks on the market for their shark fins. So it's also an issue that has to be addressed in terms of engaging local fishing communities. Global mechanisms to protect the species have to be put in place. And also industrial fisheries. I mean, for example, Spain is one of the largest industrial shark fishing countries on earth, and it's quite difficult to be able to convince the Spanish government and also the European Union to put some significant cap on the amount of sharks that are able to be caught. So it is really a concerted effort that we need to do in order to protect the species. But yeah, shark finning is really what drives such a, you know, steep decline in population numbers globally, especially for tropical sharks.
And it's legal. It's a legal practice in many countries still.
In many countries, it's an illegal practice. But in many countries, it's also a legal practice. So there has to be a global push to ensure that there are mechanisms in place to protect the species. Of course, in some countries, it's a challenge. Some countries, for example, have in their law that when you land a shark in a fish market or if the shark comes off of the boat, the fins have to be attached. And the wording of that legislation says the fin has to be attached to the animal. It doesn't say the fin has to be naturally attached to the animal. So what you see in a lot of fish markets is you have shark fins that are tied with a piece of rope to the shark. And then once they land, they conform with the laws of their respective country. They pass the fisheries inspection and then they just untie the fin off of the animal, chuck the shark carcass overboard, and then they sell the fins at premium at the market. So one of the things that we're working on, not only here in the Caribbean, but also globally, is to really ensure that proper legislation in terms of international treaties, in terms of international mechanisms, lobbying with national governments to ensure that while we recognize that fisheries and having an available source of protein for populations is important, it's also important to have a sustainable fishery for the species. So we're working on it. But yeah, some of those things are some of the craziness that we have to deal with in terms of some of our policy and legislative work.
No, why wouldn't they just keep the whole shark? I mean, people do eat shark, right?
Some species of sharks have a high level of uric acid in their meat. So the meat is actually not palatable or not fit for consumption. Some species are. Mako shark, for example, is a species that is eaten quite widely. Certain species of dogfish as well. But some species of shark, they're not caught for anything else but their fins. So yeah, they untie the fins off of the animal and then chuck the shark overboard and sell the fins at premium. It's actually quite sad to see. And I've been in the water right after an animal has been finned and chucked overboard. And you can literally see the animal gasping, trying to save itself from drowning. And then eventually the animal just drowns. So it's quite a sad sight to see.
Oh, that must be so difficult to witness. Now, why should we care if sharks are removed from the ecosystem?
That's a question that I often get. I mean, people are like, yes, but they're dangerous. And so who cares, et cetera, et cetera. And what I tell people is that they are an apex predator at the top of the food chain, and they keep the ocean ecosystem in balance. For example, here in the Caribbean, you have sharks that eat snappers that eat, let's say, sergeant majors. You remove the sharks out of the ecosystem, all of a sudden you get an explosion of snappers, which people might think is a good thing, but then eventually those snappers will eat all of the sergeant majors, which take the algae off of the coral reefs, and then there's an algal bloom on the coral reef, then the coral reef dies, and then there's no habitat for the snappers, and then you have a complete ecosystem collapse. So it's really a specific function that these apex predators fulfill within the ecosystem. And if you remove that keystone species, then you'll have a negative cascading effect on the ecosystem. And you can see it in many, especially Caribbean countries. I've spent a lot of time in Jamaica doing research into the coral reefs of Jamaica. And Jamaica is one of those places where you see that sharks have been completely fished out in the coastal waters. And one of the things that has resulted in is instead of coral dominating the reefs in Jamaica, you have algal-dominated reefs that are essentially non-functioning ecosystems. So it's critical that these apex predators remain in place to maintain that healthy ecosystem function. And of course, I'm an ecologist, so I would like to see nature be in place for nature's sake. But it's also beneficial to the economies of respective, you know, I'm from the Caribbean, so I talk about most of the things that I discuss, I take from the Caribbean perspective. So it's very critical for our island nations here in the Caribbean to maintain healthy ocean ecosystems. And sharks play an integral part in maintaining that healthy ocean ecosystem.
So what are you doing to protect them?
Do quite a bit. In the Dutch Caribbean, I live in Bonaire and work in Bonaire as a director of the Dutch Caribbean Nature Alliance. But I'm currently in St. Maarten, where I used to work previously managing the protected area here. So one of the first things that we did is we saw that there was a rapid decline in the shark population. I mean, these were animals that I knew since I was 13, 14 years old. And then all of a sudden, they just disappeared. So we made an appeal quite early on in my career here in St. Maarten in 2011. We did a study where we actually placed a dollar value on a live shark, which was $150 at market. Whereas if you maintain the animal, if you maintain a healthy population in its natural state, they can bring in to about $150,000 to the economy of the island annually. And that, together with showing the importance that the animal has on the ecosystem, we were able to approach the government of St. Martin at the time and ask for protection for the species, which was granted. So we were able to protect the species first on St. Martin. And then since that happened, we started our research. We did the BRUF surveys, which are essentially baited video cameras that we drop in the water to get an idea of our population, of the animals that we can find around the region. Then we went on to satellite tagging and tracking the animals as they migrate to the Caribbean. And sort of with that data, we were able to also get some initial funding to have a wider Caribbean program. So we involve the rest of the Dutch Caribbean. So Saba, St. Eustatius, Curaçao, Aruba, and Bonaire. And we did a wide-scale conservation project for sharks in the Dutch Caribbean. This was done through scientific research, through policy, but one of the most important components of that project was education and outreach. We made sure that we went into the schools, that we had public lectures, that we had information evenings to also inform the public of what we were doing, that it is an animal that should not be feared, that should be respected, but not be feared. And with that data, we were able to get the sharks protected throughout the Dutch Caribbean in the sanctuary. It was one of the highlights of my career that we were able to do that. But quite soon, we started to identify that it's not as if a large tiger shark that we tagged on St. Martin is going to be like, I prefer not to go to any of the neighboring islands because I'm safe in St. Martin. They migrate throughout the whole Caribbean. So 2 years now, almost, we partnered with our partner organization, Beneath the Waves. And Beneath the Waves, together with the Dutch Caribbean Nature Alliance, we recently launched the Caribbean Shark Coalition of NGOs, governments, researchers, scientists, academic institutions, et cetera, bringing everyone together to give really a bottom-up grassroots support for shark conservation work throughout the wider Caribbean. So not only the Dutch Caribbean, but everywhere from the Bahamas straight down to Trinidad. Up to now, we have about 40 entities joining the coalition, whether they're individuals or research institutions, et cetera, et cetera. And the hope is to really put in place large-scale marine protected areas in the wider Caribbean region to protect the animal through their range. Sharks that have been tagged in the Bahamas have been found off of the coast of New York. And sharks that we've tagged here on St. Martin or on the Saba Bank, we able to follow their migration all the way to the northern coast of Venezuela. We're not only trying to protect the species, but we're also using the migration of the animal to show that when you talk about the Caribbean, it's really one large marine ecosystem that has to be protected. And we use sharks to show that there's connectivity between all of the islands in the Caribbean and not only just sort of these artificial political nation states that have been put together by humans. So yeah, we're very excited. Right after this podcast, I leave to the Turks and Caicos Islands to assist with some shark tagging work there together with the folks from Beneath the Wave. We have an expedition on the Saba Bank where we're going to be tracking pregnant tiger sharks. We'll be ultrasounding them, taking blood samples for hormone analysis, et cetera, et cetera. So we're really trying to have a wider Caribbean project on protecting the species and highlighting again that they should be respected, but that they're not an animal to be feared or culled or disregarded because they do play a very critical role in the ecosystem of our Caribbean Sea.
I know that you just launched this new initiative. Do you see yourselves going beyond the Caribbean to include, like you were saying, sharks can go up to New York and down to Venezuela to just include larger areas and more countries?
The initial idea for us is to really focus on the Caribbean, but we would like to see similar initiatives like this happening in other regions as well. The United States has the American Elasmobranch Society, for example. So the idea is to really share information, share data, collaborate. I mean, collaboration is really key. It's something that we really focus on. They are experts in their field, but local knowledge is also critically important. So it's important to bring together not only scientists, not only policymakers, but also fishers and the diving industry to really have a joint collaborative push to protect these animals. So we definitely want to collaborate with North America, South America, even Europe and Africa, because some of these animals do migrate across entire ocean basins. We're excited about where we can take the Caribbean Shark Coalition.
Now, how do you catch a tiger shark to do an ultrasound on it?
Sure. So It's actually a method called drumlining. The name comes from putting drums in the water that have a long line attached to it with a baited hook. So we use a weight on the water that we have a line attached to. There's a buoy attached to that line, and I think 30 or 40 centimeters from the surface, or 30 or 40 centimeters from the bottom of the ocean floor, depending on the species, we put a baited hook. And then we check the line every hour, hour and a half. And if we have an animal on the line, we bring it to the side of the boat. We put a tail rope on to secure the animal, and then we start our workup. Now, what's interesting about many species of sharks is if you flip them upside down, they go into a state called tonic immobility. Basically, they pass out. So when you flip them upside down, the electrical receptors that it has all along its body and in its nose tend to short circuit, and you can just see them completely relax. And when that happens, yeah, we take our time, especially on a tiger shark, because they're very robust and strong animals. We take our time to ultrasound it using a basic ultrasound machine that is used for animals. We take blood, we insert a visual tag. Sometimes we attach a satellite tag to its fin so that we can track the animal in real time as it moves through its migratory pattern. So yeah, it usually takes about, depending on what we're doing, anywhere from 5 minutes to half an hour. We continuously check to see how healthy the animal is doing, if it's responding, if it's in distress in any way. And then when we're done, we cut the hook loose. We use high carbon hooks. So even if we are not able to get the hook out completely, they'll rust out within a few months. We give the animal a push. If the animal hasn't woken up yet from its anesthesia, which is its tonic immobility when you flip them upside down, oftentimes you will get in the water with them. You will actually physically swim them so that they can get the gills back pumping, and then give it a push, and then the animal swims off. So that's how we tag our sharks. And sometimes it can be intense. Sometimes, you know, there have been times when, in typical Jaws the movie style, we caught a tiger shark on the Sabre Bank, and it pulled down a massive fender that we attached to the top line, and we were like, there's no way it can pull down two. And we put two on there and it pulled down two, and then we put another one on there and it pulled down those three. So there were times when I have said, I think we need a bigger boat, guys. But yeah, I mean, that's usually how it goes. And they're actually quite easy animals to work with despite their size. I mean, a 13-foot tiger can be about 2 meters, 2.5 meters in girth. So it gets intense, but yeah, it's an awesome feeling to be physically taking scientific data off of such a massive animal.
So you reel them in, and then once they're close enough to the boat, you're able to flip them over, and they stay in the water.
Yeah. So we don't take them out of the water at all. I mean, some researchers take big animals like that out of the water. I'm not comfortable with that. I mean, it's a huge animal. It's used to being in water where there's no weight pushing down on it. But then all of a sudden, to bring it out of the water, all the pressure on its organs is not something that we want to put the animal through. So we catch it. Usually it's my job to bring the animal close to the boat. We call it walking the dog. Usually it goes back and forth, back and forth. And then once we have it in a good position, we usually work off a very small boat. So there's usually a team where I have the animal controlling the business end or the head of the animal. There's usually a team on the back of the boat that gets the tail rope on. Once the tail rope on, we attach it to a cleat on the side of the boat. And then I would usually attach it to the cleat in the front of the boat if it's a big animal. And then, yeah, we let it relax. We catch our breath, and then we flip it upside down. It goes into tonic, and then the scientific workup can start.
And I assume the boat must be moving continuously in order for the animal to get the water over its gills.
So there are two ways that sharks oxygenate themselves. One is ram ventilation. Ram ventilation, it's in the name. It's where they have to swim in order to force the water through their gills to oxygenate their blood. And the other method is buccal pumping. So some sharks can actually actively pump their gills to force the water over their gills into their bloodstream. And tigers are very, you know, tough animals, and they're able to pump water over their own gills. So you can have a tiger shark for an hour or two on the side of your boat, which we never do because we don't want to stress the animal out like that. But you can have a tiger shark for quite some time on the side of your boat without the boat really moving to do your scientific workup. So we usually don't have the boat in gear while we take data off of the animal. Some species like hammerheads, early in the podcast, I talked about this uric acid lactic acid that can build up in the muscle tissue, which makes it unpalatable to eat. but it also causes certain species that are quite sensitive to go stiff, and then they can drop to the ocean bottom and they can drown because they're so stiff that they're unable to swim because they got stressed out and the lactic acid has affected their muscles. So certain species like hammerheads, if we catch a hammerhead, we take length measurements, we might take a genetic sample, we might attach a visual tag, but we really want to get the animal off of the line and in the water swimming within 5 minutes, or else there's a risk that we lose the animal. And as researchers, one of the things that we definitely don't want to do is, number one, get bit, and then number two, cause any harm to the animal while we're trying to take research that'll contribute to its conservation. So we're very aware of, dependent on the species. And when we're tagging them, usually whoever's on the head, as we say, so whoever is controlling the business end of the animal, they're also checking to see how it's doing, if it's responding well. Certain species of sharks, they will get blotchy. So you'll see blotches appear on its skin. Reef sharks, for example, and then it's time to start to do the process of releasing it. But yeah, tiger sharks, they're my favorite animal to work with. They're very easy. They initially thrash around a little bit, but then usually they stop, which is a good thing, because if you get a 15-foot pissed off tiger shark thrashing around on the side of a 20-foot boat, it's sometimes a bit hairy, but they're usually quite easy animals to work with. Nurse sharks, on the other hand, whenever we see a nurse shark, we do a collective groan because they are so difficult to work with. But yeah.
No, I'm a diver as well. Aren't nurse sharks, like if you see a nurse shark, aren't they like the puppy dogs, or am I confusing?
Yeah, exactly.
Them? Oh,
exactly. So you see a nurse shark in the water and they're the most relaxed, chilled out animal that you can experience. Usually they're on the bottom. They don't even move. But man, when you pull up a nurse shark and you try to bring it to the side of the boat to get data off of, they spin, they thrash, they spit water at you. They're just generally not cooperative. And their skin is also tough. Just to get a visual tag in, you really have to work hard at it. But they're all beautiful to me. But if I had to choose, I would say no to nurse sharks when we have to tag them. Especially after a long tagging day and you've had a couple of 10-foot plus tigers that you've had to tag. And then all of a sudden you pull up a 12-foot nurse shark. You can hear the tagging team on board collectively groan. But
you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, you got to do what you got to do.
So do you have a story about a moment when you said to yourself, this is why I do it? A proud moment or a successful story?
Yeah, I mean, I was born and raised on St. Martin. And like I said, from a little kid, I was in the water. We had this legislation in place to protect the animal. I spent time with reef sharks and nurse sharks. But you would never see a tiger shark. So tiger sharks would just not, they're very skittish. If they're not used to divers, they will not show up. So I can remember we did the baited video cameras. And using the baited video cameras, we were able to determine, okay, we do have tiger sharks in our waters. But then being out there and not knowing if we will actually catch one to physically tag on St. Martin. And it was 2 or 3 days where we had a skunk day, which means that we didn't get anything at all, not even a nurse shark, which at that point I would have been happy to have one on the line. And it was a typical story. It was our last tagging day. The sun was setting and all of a sudden we just see the buoy being completely submerged as we're motoring the boat up to it. And then when we pulled the line up, we saw a 12-foot tiger shark, the first one ever tagged in the Dutch Caribbean. And that was really, you know, a good thing I was sweating so hard and wet from boat spray because I was shedding tears out of pure joy. And then recently, the end of April, was the first time that we were able to record a pregnant shark on St. Martin. So again, it was a typical story. We had Dr. Austin Gallagher from Beneath the Waves on board with us, Sami Katan, who is an excellent filmmaker, on board with us. It was the last day, the last hour before sunset, before we called it. We had 2 or 3 days without catching anything. And then all of a sudden we got a pretty big tiger shark that we ultrasounded it, and then we found that it was carrying pups. So that was another moment when everything, all the stress of a week of doing tagging and not being very successful, and then the last, it's always like that, the last minute of the last day, all of a sudden everything comes together and we were able to achieve our research goals. So I think those were the two moments where we're exhausted and we can't wait to take a shower because we smell like tuna blood, but we were also very happy, high fives going around, tears being shed, big smiles as we pulled into the dock. So it's an awesome feeling.
Now, what do you say to a person when they tell you they're afraid of sharks?
I mean, the first thing that many people say, oh, you shouldn't be afraid, blah, blah, blah. I was like, no, I mean, a healthy respect is important when you deal with animals like that. What you should not be is afraid to the point where either you don't go to the beach or you don't want to go swimming in the ocean, or you support wide-scale slaughter of sharks just because of unfounded fear. Statistically, it's very rare to even have an encounter with a shark unless you actively go look for that encounter. They are, again, apex predators, so everyone should have a healthy respect for them. But it's not an animal that should stop you from enjoying the ocean. On the contrary, I mean, it should be part of the fascination of being in an environment that is not home to humans, that is home to these animals, and realizing that it's part of our natural environment to have these animals in the oceans. I mean, I read also statistics that New Yorkers bite more people every year than sharks do. So people should just keep that in mind the next time they go to take a bite out of the Big Apple. If you're really worried about having a negative interaction with sharks, and there are a few things that you can do. I mean, if you're in an area, New Smyrna Beach or Cocoa Beach in Florida during the black tip migratory season, for example, stay close to shore. Don't swim during dusk and dawn, which are the peak times of the species exhibits their predatory behavior. Don't swim alone. If you're swimming with your dog, make sure that the dog also stays close to shore. So, I mean, there's a few things that you can do if you're really, really worried. But again, these are fascinating creatures. They are mysterious. They support the whole ocean ecosystem. So they deserve our respect, but definitely not any ungrounded or any unwarranted fear at all.
So I'd love to leave the listener with things that they can do themselves from wherever they are. And today I would like to divide it between listeners who are divers or even want to do some shark tourism, and then listeners in general. Let's start with the divers or people interested in shark tourism. How can they help to protect sharks?
Sure. I mean, shark tourism, it's a very important conservation tool. Not only do people get the opportunity to spend time in the water with the animal, but it also contributes to local economies. The Bahamas, they get millions and millions of dollars just because of the shark diving tourism. On the other hand, it has to be done by a reputable and a responsible operator. Oftentimes, you have these fly-by-night shark feeding operators that, you know, cause more harm than good, that cause an attack to happen, for example, or cause a disruption in the shark's feeding behavior. So my advice usually to divers is to do your research. There's enough resources available online that'll show you who the responsible shark diving operators are in whatever destination that you go to, and make sure that it's reputable, make sure that they're certified, that they have their safety protocols in place, et cetera, et cetera. If you're really interested, there's some awesome resources out there. I am going to shamelessly plug the Caribbean Shark Coalition as a resource to visit. Just Google Caribbean Shark Coalition and it'll take you right to the website. The majority of divers are certified through PADI. PADI Aware also has an excellent shark conservation program. And don't support the curio market, which is a big deal. I mean, some places they sell necklaces with shark teeth or shark jaws or shark leather goods. Please don't support them. If you want to have a souvenir, or if you want to have a shark tooth on a necklace, which I also have, get a fossilized shark tooth, which are available everywhere. You can get a fossilized shark tooth from a shark that's a couple million years old, and I can guarantee you that it wasn't killed a few weeks ago just for its shark teeth or its jaws. So that's what I usually would tell the folks that spend time or that want to spend time in the water with these animals.
Just real quick. So for example, when I'm doing research, trying to find a reputable company, are there some red flags to look for? Like, let's say if TripAdvisor, somebody says, I was able to swim right next to the whale shark, or I could touch the whale shark. Those type of things you know they're not good.
Yep, definitely. Those are definitely red flags. I mean, and you hit the nail on the head. There are some places in the Philippines where they have been throwing fish meal in the water for people to be able to swim with whale sharks, and it has made the whale sharks completely dependent on that activity for their food source. They're not interested in feeding themselves anymore, which also makes them vulnerable to fishing pressure. I mean, people know that these animals frequent that area because they're being fed, so they know that that's the area where they should go if they want to fish these animals out. Track records in terms of people being bitten, safety protocols. If you find a reputable shark diving company, They should have their protocols in place, what is allowed, what is not allowed, how they feed the animal. I mean, if you're with a good shark diving company, they just present very little food to the animal every time they have a shark feed so that the animal doesn't become used to humans hand feeding them instead of them actively exhibiting their natural behavior. So those are, yeah, the red flags that I would definitely recommend that they look at. And just, you know, if you've never heard about a shark diving company before, or if, you know, if it doesn't have a review on TripAdvisor, or if you pay $20 for a shark dive while the standard is about $85 to $90, then that is not someone you want to get into the water with, not only for the animal's sake, but I can guarantee you for your own sake as well.
That's really good advice. And I'm going to make a list of all of this and put it in the show notes for people to refer to, and for myself, because I like to dive, so I want to remember all of that. Now, what about the general listener? Do you have any advice for how a general listener can help?
Yeah, sure. If you're not a diver, but you're interested in the plight of sharks, I mean, I call it a plight because, you know, 500 million animals being fished out of the ocean every year is quite a bit. There are excellent resources out there. Oceana has excellent shark resources. Paddy Aware, again, Caribbean Shark Coalition website, Beneath the Waves website, excellent shark information. The Shark Project also has excellent shark information. And yeah, realize that these animals are under such significant pressure that they're some of the most endangered animals, not only in the ocean, but also generally speaking. And educate yourself, realize that these are animals in their own natural environment. Don't order shark fin soup or any shark-related products. Shark cartilage, for example, which people think is a cure-all for arthritis, for example, and there's no scientific data to support that. Same with shark oil. Certain fish oils are also this omega-3 fish oil that are sold at health food stores as a supplement. They usually contain shark liver, which is something that puts immense pressure on the sharks. Consuming shark meat, and shark meat can be high in heavy metals, mercury especially. So just avoid eating them as well. It's generally a good idea in seafood. The Monterey Bay Aquarium has an excellent resource to show what are the types of sustainable seafoods that you should eat and that you should avoid. Of course, sharks are on the avoid list. These type of little things and just general responsible environmental behavior, reducing plastic consumption, calling for your political leadership and people in government to enact conservation rules, not only shark conservation rules, but generally ocean conservation and ocean good governance legislation. These type of things not only contribute to the conservation of the species, but to the health of our oceans in general. So that's usually what I tell folks when they ask me what they can do. And if you have the means to do it, donate to some of the excellent organizations out there that have folks in the field that especially do education and outreach, because as scientists, we often focus on doing the research, but education and outreach is also a critical part of ensuring that the species is protected efficiently. So yeah, that would be my advice.
Tadzio, this has been really interesting and exciting. Thank you so much for all that you do. You're making
Thank
a difference.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Can you imagine trying to flip over an angry 15-foot tiger shark? I think it's needless to say that Tadzio is dedicated to his cause. And thank goodness he is. Sharks have been around since before the dinosaurs, but it could be us humans that wipe them off this planet. Having been in the water with sharks myself, my experience says that they really want nothing to do with us. In fact, many attacks are either cases of mistaken identity. For example, from below, a person paddling on a surfboard looks an awful lot like a tasty sea lion, or someone just doing something stupid. Regardless, I could understand that people might still have a fear of them. The important thing is to recognize and respect the value that they bring to the world, and support the means to protect them. Don't forget to go to forcesfornature.com and sign up to receive emailed show notes, action tips, and a free guide to help you start taking practical actions today. Do you know someone else who would enjoy this episode? I would be so grateful if you would share it with them. Hit me up on Instagram and Facebook and let me know what actions you have been taking. Adopting just one habit can be a game changer, because imagine if a million people also adopted that. What difference for the world are you going to make today?